They may not always be near the front of the newspaper, but the entertainment pages and weekend supplements are an integral part of a newsstand's DNA. But in a rapidly changing media world, what does it take to keep the titles up to speed with modern reading habits? We'll find out today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll be crossing over to New York to hear from the editor-in-chief of Entertainment Weekly magazine, Henry Goldblatt.
I remember as a subscriber to this magazine, coming home on a Friday and just like trying to guess what the cover topic would be and knowing that whatever was on the cover was the most important story in entertainment that week. And so that's what I've tried to do since I've been back.
But first today, over the last few weeks, we've been speaking to the editors of some of our favorite weekly titles. We've been to Germany and Italy. Today, we're taking a leap across the pond for a look at one of our favorite weekly supplements, the New York Times Magazine. The publication enjoys a reputation not only for its in-depth analysis of the week's news, but also for its creative and thought-provoking covers. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to one of the people behind those covers, design director Gail Bickler.
The paper often covers things in a very timely way. We do sometimes also cover things in a pretty timely way, but we often do more long-form journalism and do things that often have a little bit more attitude, or we sometimes publish pieces that are more opinion pieces or kind of philosophical takes on things.
And of course, as the design director of the magazine, you know, one of your main jobs is also to decide on the cover. That must be quite an exciting job. And I know that you try, you know, a lot of different covers. For example, I believe it was an issue from last November, December, excuse me, but it's the one about the skyscrapers in New York, where the magazine was, everything was in a different position, right?
Yes, we rotated the entire magazine 90 degrees because the issue was about life above 800 feet. And we wanted to make use of the tallest dimension of the magazine. So we redesigned the entire thing to be in a vertical format.
And if I may ask, what's the main story of this week, of this upcoming New York Times on Sunday?
Our cover is a story on feminism by a writer named Amanda Hess. And the reason for writing it was the big women's march in Washington and around the world. But it's really a bigger piece that takes a historical look at feminism and really looks at race and class and the representations of that within the feminist movement. So it really looks back at the history of feminism leading up to the election and how feminists responded to having a female president, and also the idea that feminism was really a catalyst for people to resist on the left. So women really could be leaders of a new movement against some of the policies being implemented by the Trump administration. But it also looks at the ways that its past could actually impact its ability to move forward in a way that's effective. One of the things that is talked about in the piece is just how many different platforms were a part of that movement and, you know, whether or not they can kind of unify in a way that allows them to lead.
For example, a cover story like this, how long did you decide that this would be the cover for this week? Because I understand that you do long form, but is there a case that sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of a last minute rush to change the cover because of a special topic coming out?
Yes, that actually happens quite a bit. And it's really happening a lot now with the new administration. So this story was in the works for about 2 weeks. It really started maybe a couple weeks before the Women's March. So it was pretty quick in terms of getting a cover executed. So that's been happening more and more.
And Gabe, if I may ask, besides the feminist story, what other range of topics are you covering in this week's issue?
Well, there's a story about a Baptist minister from Louisiana whose son died while in police custody. And the sheriff's department there said that he committed suicide, even though he was actually handcuffed. They basically said that he somehow was able to reach a gun that he had and shoot himself. And so the story is a lot about the minister's struggle to figure out what happened and get justice for his son And then there's also another story about a transhumanist candidate for president, a guy named Zoltan Istvan, who drove across country in a coffin-shaped immortality bus campaigning on a transhumanist platform, which espouses diverting funds from away from other government spending like war and into the science of life extension. And it's a great piece. The writer traveled for a portion of time with Istvan, and the writing is about that experience.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to read this issue then. And finally, Gayle, you know, of course, you're the design director. You chose the cover, some of the illustrations as well. What's your relationship with the editor of the magazine, Jake Silverstein? Does he sometimes say, well, I don't think this might work? I mean, I wonder how many meetings do you have in a week, for example?
We have a very close relationship. We often meet a number of times a week about a certain cover. Sometimes we're actually pursuing a couple different cover directions, both on one story or possibly on a couple different stories. But it's a very, it's a close relationship, and we are often talking about images and how they would work with lines and kind of adjusting both the imagery and the language to work better together. Yeah, we're in constant contact.
That was Gayle Bickler, design director of the New York Times, speaking to our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Still to come here on The Stack, I'll be speaking to the editor-in-chief of Entertainment Weekly, Henry Goldblatt. Stay with us.
Press Briefing, brought to you by The Stack on Monocle 24. If you were completing a high school assignment sometime from the late 90s onwards, you were probably told that Wikipedia couldn't be cited as a reference. Well, the online encyclopedia is going one better. They've banned British tabloid The Daily Mail, labelling the newspaper an unreliable source. Wikipedia's editors said their decision centred on The Daily Mail's reputation for poor fact-checking, sensationalism, and flat-out fabrication. Wikipedia is operated by the Wikimedia Foundation, though the group does not control the site's editing guidelines. A statement released by the foundation said the decision was largely the result of a general consensus among its editors.
Based on the requests for comments section, volunteer editors on English Wikipedia have come to the consensus that the Daily Mail is generally unreliable and its use as a reference is to be generally prohibited, especially when other more reliable sources exist.
Now, what do you get when you put Donald Trump in a room with the British politician Michael Gove and one Mr. Rupert Murdoch? Well, if your answer was an interview published by the Times of London, you are correct. When the Times unveiled what was dubbed the first newspaper interview with the new American president, it came with truckloads of fanfare. But it seems the newspaper was conspicuously quiet on the presence of Mr. Murdoch. According to a report in the Financial Times this week, the man at the top of News Corp's food chain was actually sitting quietly in the room as Michael Gove, a prominent Conservative politician who championed for Britain's exit from the European Union, interviewed the man he described as sporting skin that glows a sodium orange. The FT also writes that Trump and Murdoch are in regular contact. Rupert Murdoch has been busy running the Fox News Channel since the ousting of Roger Ailes. He's since positioned the network squarely behind the new president and even handpicked the successor to Megyn Kelly, fellow Trump supporter Tucker Carlson.
You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, the rise of online media often comes with the assumption that some pockets of the traditionally print-focused sector will eventually die out, a constant theme on this program. But Entertainment Weekly magazine is continuing to buck that trend. Since its debut issue in 1990, the magazine has carved itself an admirable spot on the newsstand, but it's also brought its online presence under the wing of its print brand. EW.com is the seventh most visited entertainment website on the internet. And joining me now on the line from New York is the magazine's editor, Henry Goldblatt. Hello, Henry.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, not at all. Let's maybe start rewind and go down memory lane a bit. I have to disclose as well, I wrote for Entertainment Weekly once upon a time in the very, very early days when I was a fledgling cub reporter.
That's excellent. Do you remember your first story?
I don't. I think it might have been an interview with Christy Turlington or something. We'll have to go back and look through the bound editions and find out. But early days, and you know, maybe it's a good place to start because that was in many ways a golden era of magazines. We can all look back at the late 80s, early 90s, and particularly a company at that point like Time Warner, Time Inc. As a magazine business then. Was all mahogany lined walls, and I can remember every editor seemed to have their own ensuite bathroom, and it was quite an amazing time. Maybe let's just talk about the start of Entertainment Weekly and what niche it sought to fill and the role you're playing today.
Absolutely. Well, as you said, Entertainment Weekly started in 1990, and there was nothing like it at the time, which sort of seems weird given all sort of the competition in entertainment news space today. And it was the idea was to bring the trades to the masses. So the box office information, the TV ratings, stuff that people and entertainment geeks were really, really excited about, they didn't quite have access to it, of course, in the same way that they did today. And, we just recently moved offices, and I unearthed the memo that Jeff Jarvis, the founding editor, wrote about Entertainment Weekly, and it was and he made a big stand that this magazine has to be weekly as opposed to monthly because this information is so timely in a weekly fashion. Of course, 25, 26 years later, that's entirely different. But we still try to adhere to that core DNA, which is making entertainment speak to both the trade industry and to the lay people who are just interested in entertainment itself, and that DNA sort of sticks to us today.
And it's interesting when you think back, because obviously the trades and everyone knows the roles, whether it was the Hollywood Reporter or Variety, all these different titles played at that time. And I guess there was that constituency of reader, who was a layperson. They were not out, optioning film rights, but they were just very interested in getting an edge on figuring out what were going to be, the major series that the U.S. networks were going to bring out, what movies were in production, etc. As we know, all of that's much easier to get today. But in its moment, what was the reception? And I guess I'm also keen to know the relationship today that you have with agents and studios. How has that evolved and changed?
It's interesting. So I can't speak to the reception per se in 1990 because I was definitely not.
Let's pretend. make it up.
It's to your point. It is the relationship with Hollywood has changed and evolved, and the way entertainment, of course, is produced has changed and evolved. And so it's not just looking at the studios and the agents anymore and the networks every September what they're rolling out on TV. We covered the TV season 24/7. We covered DIY entertainment in a way that just didn't exist, of course, 25 years ago, and the fact that I can go home, I can turn on a camera, and I can be a TV programmer myself is a stunning revelation that you wouldn't have thought would have had. No one could have predicted 25 years ago. And so it's covering entertainment through a lens of wherever it's happening and also making sure that our readers can consume it wherever they want to, be it on their phone or be it in print form or be it through skywriting or whatever the next technology is. We want to make sure that the brand is there.
Yeah, and on that, maybe let's talk about the evolution. The magazine that you inherited, I guess it's roughly 2 years ago that you came into the fold. What was presented then, and I guess what was expected of the group's management in giving you this post, and what the ambitions were then, and I guess has anything changed? I guess since you got the editor's chair.
So I was at Entertainment Weekly. I started in 2002, and then I was there until 2014 and spent a year at People Magazine with my boss, Jess Cagle, and then came back, as you said, to run the magazine about 2 years ago. And the thing that I wanted to reinstill that from the magazine's heyday, if you will, is that I remember as a subscriber to this magazine coming home on a Friday and just trying to guess what the cover topic would be, and knowing that whatever was on the cover was the most important story in entertainment that week or was going to set the agenda in the conversation for entertainment that week. And so that's what I've tried to do since I've been back. And in particular, I've been interested in implementing this first look strategy, and that I've been giving readers a first look at projects that may be coming out 6, 9, 12, 18 months down the road, but we're literally the destination where you're going to see and get the first information on this. For example, we did this with Beauty and the Beast back in October, and of course the film is coming out soon. It sort of this strategy sort of plays to the symbiosis of how the print and online properties work together. The studio is very excited to still get a print magazine cover. We broke it on a Wednesday. That next day, we had record traffic both in uniques and page views, the best traffic in 9 years on EW.com, both mobile and desktop. And then it sort of snakes throughout the system, the ecosystem. It goes through our social feeds, and there was record traffic there as well. And we get feedback from our readers and then feedback on the newsstand and end up being one of our best-selling issues of last year. This strategy sort of speaks to the 360 and holistic way that you have to look at the media industry today.
And what I hear, I guess, you know, throughout all of that is you have become a trade. I mean, the trades, you know, are as much part of, the editorial ecosystem as anyone else. I mean, it's all up for grabs, I guess. And that's really sort of positioned you in a different way. Because if I think back to, my goodness, London in the early 90s, there weren't that many places where you could get Entertainment Weekly. Nevertheless, you could go to Tower Records. You know, there was the odd newsstand where you could find it. And there was that, you know, excitement, as you said, there was that excitement about the cover. So I'm just wondering, what is the, you know, the relationship now when you've got, you know, of course, so many sites which are there to break the news first, many of them consumer, not even, let's say, trade sites. And you've, of course, got, you still got sort of very, well-armed, trades editorially as well. So, you know, is it a case that, you know, everyone is your competitor?
It is, unfortunately. It sometimes feels like we're being attacked by 1,000 pinpricks on all sides. But yes, we have the competitors, as you say, by the trades, you know, the Hollywood Reporters, Varieties, the Deadlines, the TV Lines, the Wraps. And then we have sort of the more glossy print competitors from GQ and Esquire and Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone, of course. And so on the one hand, I like to say that we have like thousands of competitors. On the other hand, I like to say we have no competitors because no one quite does the secret sauce, the ketchup and mustard and mayonnaise and everything that we put into this brand each week. Nobody does it quite the same way, which makes us pretty unique.
Tell me, you talked about the studios and I guess the network's excitement still when they get a cover. So for, you know, whether it's, you know, a new show being launched or it's someone up for award, there they are on the cover of Entertainment Weekly. What is it about getting an EW cover versus a lot of traffic, a lot of clicks on your website? You know, from your point of view, and obviously someone who, you've obviously been in the print fold for a while. What does a good old magazine do that something digital can't?
I can tell you that actually very concretely. We put This Is Us, the new NBC hit show, on the cover in September, I think second or third week in. They had been on hiatus for a week or two because there were some political debates or whatever. This Is Us came back right after our cover came out, and the ratings were up week over week by like a million or so viewers, and I got a note from the president of NBC crediting our cover for that.
Well, there you go. I mean, what more do you need? What is that point of connection? Do you think because the cover is a different point of access, I'm walking through Newark Airport, I see it, I spot someone, you know, potentially, you know, at a bus stop in L.A. reading it. What is it from, it's not just a physical point of view, but what do you think it's delivering, you know, above and beyond what happens electronically?
I think because the cover sets the agenda for whatever Entertainment Weekly is covering that week. So as I was saying, we push it through digitally, we push it through socially. It's the story that we're touting in the biggest way that week. So it's not just the cover itself, and certainly NBC can hold it up and put it in TV ads, and it's certainly a sign of endorsement, but it's the way that we're able to get behind something in a big way using all of Entertainment Weekly's muscles and all of our platforms in order to promote this show or movie.
Mm. Just, of course, a lot of people are in the media trade who listen to this program. What is the metabolism? Tell me about your editorial setup. If we were to walk onto the editorial floor, I guess the importance of New York and I guess your West Coast bureau as well, what is the editorial metabolism across the week?
Sure, that's a really good question. Everybody on the staff has jobs that span across all platforms. So somebody may be spending 70% of their time digitally and 20% of their time socially and 10% of their time in print. Hopefully that adds up to 100. Some people may be the inverse. And so if I've staffed this place correctly, I have a staff of people who have very diverse interests, but B, a staff of people who are covering all platforms and are experts in all platforms at all times. I'm very, very psyched. We just announced yesterday that we launched a Snapchat Discover channel. We're the third title and timing to do that, and I'm very excited about that. And I've got someone on staff who's going to be spending 70-80% of their time doing that, and thankfully that's not going to be me because I'm not the biggest Snapchat guy in the world.
Join the club. Tell me, when we look at, people's, the percentages and how they're sort of divided up, I'm still focusing on, you know, you still have longer form pieces. There's significant reporting on page. And I guess, as we know, you know, long form still belongs on the printed page. How important and what is the relationship, I guess, when you're talking to a studio, et cetera, and you say, look, this is the person that we are going to deploy for the interview. Does that still matter today when we're looking? It's an era of urgency and who's going to get it out first? Or is there still that sort of concern that, yeah, look, this is serious. EW is deploying this writer. You know, they mean business.
It actually works both ways. I've got a writer named James Hibbard who owns the Game of Thrones beat. He's the only writer actually in all of Hollywood who's allowed on the set. He teases out news digitally for weeks and weeks and weeks beforehand, working very, very closely with the network. He will be writing all of our Game of Thrones cover stories in the magazine. It's sort of our, Game of Thrones is our premier franchise, of course. It does very, very well for us. I've got another guy named Anthony Bresnikan who owns the Marvel and the Star Wars beats. And, you know, these are relationships that have been built over years and years and decades, and the studios come to trust them and know that they're reliable and fair journalists, and you know that their talent is superior. And that type of relationship that's built over years, you can't replace that.
Just before we go, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about audience, and maybe again, you've got a history, certainly, you know, within the editorial world of what was, you know, the Time Inc. that we all know, and of course, you know, the way the company has evolved today. Are you bringing people along with you? You know, you talk about obviously that there is, you know, you do things on Snapchat, etc. You know, is it super broad and diverse, or would you say there's still a core which, yeah, they've grown up with you, or you've had to grow up with them?
We are bringing new people along, thankfully, which is great because otherwise I don't think this brand is going to survive otherwise. So yeah, we are bringing in a new audience. And the thing that's great is the thing that this audience has in common, whether it's a 50-year-old man in the Midwest or if it's a 20-year-old in L.A. who's just starting out, they're such pop culture fanatics. And the type of pop culture that they might consume is entirely different, but it's like a club. And we want to be the nexus and center for this club.
And just before we wrap, I'm interested in percentages in terms of television and sort of, let's say, traditional networks versus, of course, what the Netflix and the Amazons are delivering versus film. And then, yeah, the broader world of whether we're talking music, etc. Where's your heartland today? If you'd say you're doing 40-50% of one thing and then sort of dividing up, or does it depend on sort of the cycles of the season?
It depends a little bit on the cycles of the season, but as you can imagine, over the past 5 to 7 years, it's shifted from movies to TV because that's where a lot of the creative energy in Hollywood has shifted from. And I use TV very broadly to include the streaming services as well. I'd say that probably 60, 65, maybe some years 70% of our covers end up being TV-based. And I think if you'd looked at the magazine 10 years ago or certainly 15 years ago, it would be the inverse.
Henry Goldblatt, editor-in-chief of Entertainment Weekly in New York, talking to us on The Stack. Have a very good weekend.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's all for this week's edition of The Stack. Big thanks to our producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course, our editor, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the same time next Saturday. And you can always listen again, of course, at monocle.com or via iTunes. If you fancy buying some of the titles mentioned on The Stack, do pay a visit to Kiosk Cafe when you're in London. That's our very own international newsstand right near Paddington Station here in London. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé. Just before we go, though, to play us out, here's a little something from Tangerine Dream. This is Love on a Real Train.